This morning, in this part of the program, we'll be talking with Mark Hertzgaard. He's a journalist and author. He's written for a number of publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, Harper's, Vanity Fair, Outside. He's also the author of several books, and we have talked about them on this show. One of them about the life and artistry of the Beatles, another about the relationship between the press and the presidency during the Reagan administration, a third about the men and money behind nuclear energy. His most recent, and we'll talk a little bit about this morning, is the product of a rather long trip that he took. Starting in 1991, he set out to travel around the world and visited 19 countries in 6 years, talked with a number of different people in different places. And the basic idea, the question he was exploring, is the question of environment, and very specifically the question of whether human beings would be able to deal with the serious environmental crises that confront all of us. That book is Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. It was first published in the winter of 1999. It's still out, available in a paperback edition if people want to look at it. He was on the program. We talked about that book that after about a month or so after it had been out. And in fact, we've talked so many times that this is now, I think, his fourth time on the show. So we're really pleased. And this time he's here in person, so we're really pleased to have him here. He's here in part to speak about environmental issues on the global scale as part of the MillerCom series, and we've had a lot of these people on this show. It's been a great source of guests for us. He'll be talking tonight on the U of I campus at 7:30 at the Levis Center, and it's free, open to the public, anybody who would like to attend. We will talk a little bit about that topic, but also a bit about the subject of what will be his next book that's certainly very, very timely. And we'll get into that in just a little bit here. But also, as we talk, I want to make sure that people know questions are welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks, and toll-free 800-222-9455. That's the toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. Well, it's very nice to have you here.
It's nice to be here in person. I hadn't realized we'd done four of these.
I believe so. I think at least we talked about Unbended Knee. We talked about A Day in the Life. We talked about Earth Odyssey. So those three. So
that's true.
It would be the fourth. Well, maybe we'll talk a little bit about the environment just to start out here. It's been now since you embarked on the journey that led to that book. It's been 10 years.
Yes.
After 10 years, how are we doing? Can one say that we've actually made some progress?
I think there's been progress in some realms. It's interesting, you know, when I set out to do that book, one of the working hypotheses was that some environmental experts were saying we have 10 years to begin to turn these trends around, or they will take on too much momentum ever to turn around. Mm-hmm. And I didn't necessarily believe that, but I thought it was an interesting hypothesis. And so now here 10 years later, you'd have to say that if they were right, no, we have not done enough to turn things around. I do see progress in a couple of areas. One is population. Population growth has come down in some parts of the world. And in particular, I think there was a very meaningful advance made in Cairo in 1994 at the UN conference, where for once, not only did the world get together and talk about these things, but they actually came up with a solid, practical solution that everyone signed on to. That, in a phrase, comes down to if you want to bring population growth under control, you need to emancipate women. You need to educate girls. You need to show and allow women to have other roles in the society in addition to being a mother, not exclusively, but in addition to that. And when you do that, you see not just population growth rates coming down, but poverty coming down and a general improvement in the society. So I think that's one area where there's a small progress been made. Ozone depletion, again, some progress has been made there. But ozone illustrates just how difficult progress is because, yes, we've got a good agreement, and yes, our emissions of CFCs, the chemical that destroys the ozone layer, those are going down. But because of the lag time of this problem, the ozone hole itself, or holes, I should say, are actually getting bigger and will be getting bigger for the next 15 years. So, and then on the larger, probably the single most urgent problem right now, global warming, you'd have to say that things have gotten much worse, much faster, despite the We do have one important development very recently, of course, this very month. Most of the nations of the world, with the singular exception of the United States, have agreed on how to implement the Kyoto Accord on global warming. But the price of getting that agreement, especially because the Bush administration boycotted it, has been to water down that agreement to a point where it will do virtually nothing in the next 10 years when progress is most urgently needed.
Yesterday I sat down and listened back to the conversation we had about Earth Odyssey, and one of the things that you said that I thought was an important kind of a thing to talk about and for people to understand was where we could talk about a variety of issues, environmental issues being important, global warming being one, or energy use and overuse being another, or water issues being a lot of different things. But the thing that you said was very striking was that perhaps the biggest environmental problem in the world was poverty, and that the big challenge is going to be, as people seek to better themselves and improve their standard of living, how are we going to do that? And are we going to do it in a way that is going to be really heavy on the environment, or a way that's as light as we can possibly make it? The point, the very clear point is that if you look at the level of consumption, of waste production that exists in the developed world today in a country like this, for example, and then you look at, we'd spend a lot of time talking about China and that conversation, and you look at China, you look at how many people there are, that it's pretty clear that there's no way that they can do what we have done and what we are doing now.
That's true.
The planet just wouldn't take it.
No, we'd need two more planets. That's the calculation that you hear. If the rest of the world were to have not even the American standard, but just the European standard of consumption, you'd need three planet Earths. And I don't think anybody in their wildest imaginations thinks we can do that. So, yeah, that is really, I think, the overarching problem, which is that, look, 45% of the people on this planet, 45% of the 6 billion people who live on planet Earth subsist on $2 a day or less. And there is just no way that they're going to continue to accept that. I think back to the phrase of Jefferson writing about the slaves, and I think it's the same. He said that there is nothing more surely written in the Book of Fate than that someday these people shall be free. And that goes for people who are very poor around the world, too, and especially because now with modern communications, they are not being poor in isolation. They are seeing or hearing through the mass media that there are other people who have a lot more than they do, and that naturally encourages a certain amount of envy and resentment and desire to have that themselves. And so the real challenge for us as a species, I think, is can we find a way to accommodate, and I would argue we should be encouraging those people to arise out of poverty, but can we do that in such a way that we don't end up wrecking the life support systems that make our existence possible? I think we can. And I tried to lay out at the end of Earth Odyssey a proposal for doing that, something called the Global Green Deal, which would actively make restoring and repairing our environment into the biggest jobs and business stimulus program of our time, realizing that more economic growth of the traditional sort will kill us. But we can have, and indeed we must have, economic growth of the restorative sort, such that we would be using less energy. We would be installing energy-efficient technologies, insulation and better lighting and so forth here. And in China, we would be installing those same kinds of technologies. And the great thing about that is that that kind of work is very labor-intensive. It produces far more jobs per dollar of investment than doing what, say, the Bush energy program does, which is to throw a lot of money at nuclear power plants and oil refineries. And that's very, very urgent, getting back to your point of poverty. Right now, we have over a billion people on this planet who don't have work. And that, my friends, is a recipe for instability and more of the kind of unspeakable attacks that happened on September 11th. Mm-hmm. And we have got to realize that attacking poverty is in our own self-interest.
Well, you made that argument particularly this argument about the Green Deal. And we talked about that before, and made that argument. That said, not only is this be good for overall for the environment, for any developing country that adopted that as a strategy, it would be good for them because it generates jobs. It would even be good for countries in the developed world like the United States, because here it opens up a market for selling energy efficient stuff, for transferring technology and knowledge and so forth. Having said all that, is there any place in the world that you can point to where they're actually doing it, where they're actually trying to do it?
Sure. I think it is happening, though, much more on the local and state levels than on the national level. And the media does a less good job of reporting on that stuff. For example, there's a group I admire a lot out of Canada called Destination Conservation. And they have gone into 3,000 schools across Canada and done these environmental retrofits. Very basic stuff. This is not cutting-edge technology. This is things like, you know, low-flow showers and energy-efficient light bulbs and recycling rather than waste dump. And they are saving a guaranteed savings of 25% off the operating budgets of these schools every year. That's a lot of money. And that is money that you can then, if you're the school board or the mayor, put that into buying more books or computers or maybe paying your teachers a living wage. How about that for a radical idea? Or reducing your class sizes so that the teachers can do a better job of educating our kids. They've done this in Canada with 3,000 schools. They're now coming to California. They're starting it in the San Francisco and I believe San Diego areas, hundreds of schools there. So we're seeing those kinds of initiatives, and I could go on and on about individual things over in Europe, for example. And one of the nice things, I was just speaking at Cornell the other day, they're part of an effort by a number of campuses around the United States to implement the Kyoto Accord on their own campus, rather than wait for the federal government to move on this, because the federal government seems blocked by the basically oil industry pressure. Through big money contributions, you're seeing campuses and small towns and municipalities in the United States and Europe saying, we're not going to wait for the federal government to figure this out. We're going to do it on our own here. And I think that that is a very useful initiative. Granted, it would be a lot better if the government got behind this. We would move a lot more quickly. And I think it's shameful that the United States has been so recalcitrant on this. But there are signs of movement.
Yeah. It does. I was even interested in a lot of the reaction to the Bush energy proposals, in that people, a lot of people that I would not have thought particularly would have been considered themselves environmental activists, reacted to the proposal which was basically about production, increasing energy production, giving very little thought to conservation or greater efficiency, in fact, denigrating the very idea. That an awful lot of people said, average people said, well, now, wait a minute. Wouldn't it be a good idea if we tried to find ways to use less energy? Why it is that just seemed not on the mind of the administration. It just was not. They sort of brushed it off, you know.
It's not hard to see why it's not on the mind.
Well,
of the
is that really what it comes down to?
You know, these are not the Bush-Cheney people. They are not the world's, most broad-minded individuals, especially on questions of energy. They have all spent. I mean, George W. Bush literally was born into the oil business, spent his entire life in the oil business. His daddy was an oil man. He himself failed spectacularly as an oil man. In a way, you can't blame them. You know, it's like asking somebody who was brought up a Catholic to suddenly become a Jew. They were brought up in the religion of oil. And it's, I think, very hard for them to conceive of any solution to these problems that doesn't involve more oil.
We still do seem, though, to have a problem with we need a lot of energy, and that we could certainly do a great deal with more efficient use of energy. If all of the devices that we have that use energy use less, that would be a great thing. It would make a big difference. But we still consume an awful lot of energy.
True.
And that seems at the moment not to leave us very many alternatives. We still seem to fall back on, at least in a lot of people in their minds, they're still falling back on fossil fuels or the possibility of nuclear generation. And green technologies still seem to be having a very tough time because there are people, there continues to be research on solar. There are people looking at wind power. I think just recently, in fact, I read an article about the fact that here in the state of Illinois, for example, some people were identifying places where they thought the wind was significant enough so that a significant number of turbines could be put up and you could generate, you know, enough energy so that it would make it worthwhile putting it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually taking that energy and selling it to somebody that would mm-hmm. distribute it. So it's not that people aren't talking about those things or looking at those things. It still seems, though, that the edge goes to the old conventional carbon-based forms, and it's still very difficult for anybody else to compete.
Well, it does go that way because our public policy remains very skewed in favor of that. And that happens at the federal level. You know, in the 1970s, under President Carter, there were active federal subsidy programs, and you could get tax rebates for putting solar into your house and so forth. Reagan came in 1980, killed off all that stuff, resumed and increased the subsidies to coal and oil and nuclear, and that has an effect. You know, he basically destroyed the emerging solar power industry in the United States. That hasn't stopped it from happening overseas. But it certainly put a big crimp in it here. Now, having said that, there are also a lot of big companies in the United States who see the opportunities for energy efficiency and are pushing on that. And these are not, you know, these are things like Maytag and Johnson & Johnson and Honeywell and so forth. So it's in flux. And some of the strongest pressure for moves in this direction. Again, people are leaving behind the federal government, even in the private sector, and saying, we're just going to do this on our own because the economics are so compelling. And this is what, I must say, drives me a little crazy, the hypocrisy of companies like British Petroleum or Shell, who make a big deal out of being, as BP likes to say now, we are beyond petroleum. And indeed, in their own internal operations, what they are doing is energy efficiency. Changing their factories, changing their offices, greatly reducing their profits, making a lot of money internally on this. And yet, in terms of what they're selling out to the society, they're still selling the same old gas-guzzling cars, if you're Ford and GM, or the oil that BP and Shell are selling. That, to me, is really what people should be focusing on, is the private sector is making money hand over foot with energy efficiency. Why shouldn't we as taxpayers be demanding that the public sector is doing that too? Why is it that only the private sector gets to make money at this?
When you do surveys and you go out and you ask people, is the environment important to you? They, of course, everybody said, well, yes. Is it something that on the policy level we should be addressing? And, you know, ask them all those questions. They'll tell you that it's very important, these issues are important, that we ought to be doing something about it. If you look, though, at actually what people do in their daily lives, are there significant numbers of people who have actually done something different or have consciously tried to follow through on that idea? Or is it something that we just say is important to us, and then when you look at what we do, our actions don't square up with our words?
I think it's mixed, very mixed. You can't have any other conclusion when you look at, you know, the polls you mentioned where, say, even 89% of the Republican voters in last year's presidential election said, the environment matters to me, and I will take that into account when I pick my candidate. And the numbers are even higher on the Democratic side, but not that much higher. But wait a minute. You know, half the country is buying and driving SUVs. So there is a disconnect there. No question. But part of that disconnect, I think, is because people still don't quite understand that saving the environment can actually be good for the economy. There is an assumption that if I help the environment, I'm going to endanger my own economic well-being. And that exists around the world, I must say, from my own research. And finally, on that point, I think part of the responsibility there is surely the media's, that they sort of blindly repeat this old mantra that, the environment means a cost of jobs. But another part of the responsibility is the environmental movement itself. The environmental movement has been done a very poor job at articulating an economic message, at saying to average middle-class and working-class Americans that we can save the environment and it will give you a better job. Now, the environmental groups believe that, but they haven't come out with a strong, clear statement of how you do it, like, say, a global Green Deal. And I think part of the reason, with all due respect, is that most environmentalists in these organizations are upper-middle-class people. They have plenty of money. It doesn't matter to them if, say, one paycheck were to be missed, because they got enough in the bank. And so they don't quite understand how to reach out to their fellow citizens who are not quite so well off, and that you've got to put an economic message front and center that is practical, that is not just idealistic and vague, something that says, this is what we're going to do, say a global Green Deal, that will put you to work at a better job, at a higher wage, and tie it into these campaigns for the living wage and to raise the general income level in the society that has gotten so terribly skewed in the last 10 years between rich and poor.
We're about midway through this part of Focus 580, and our guest is Mark Hertzgard. He's a journalist, author. He's written several books. His most recent explores this subject here we've been talking about in the first part of the show. The title of that book is Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. It is available in bookstores now. Is it Broadway, also the paperback
Broadway books.
Publisher? Broadway Books. And he's also here visiting Champaign-Urbana. He'll be talking about this and other subjects in a talk as part of the MillerCom series. So if you're here locally and you'd like to hear more from him, you can turn out for the talk tonight, 7:30 at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. And these are always free and open to anybody who would like to attend. And questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, Taylorville, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I venture to submit that although there has been a little progress made here and there around the planet, that mankind itself is going eventually the way of the well-known dodo. And I recall this bit of doggerel that you'll sometimes see in sleazy taverns and sleazy neighborhoods behind the bar. We grow too soon old and too late smart. I think that's the story of the human race. The population problem, although it's slowing down some, hasn't stopped. And if you want some interesting nightmares, just picture what this planet is going to look like in not just another century, another half century. Bali, for example, was a fabled little island 50 years ago. Since then, I think the population has more than doubled, and I don't think it has quite as much vegetation as it used to. That's a euphemism, as it used to. This sort of thing is going on around the planet. There's more crud going into our oceans every year, not just the airborne hydrocarbons. This country, incidentally, contributes. It doesn't have a third of the world's planet's population. About one third automotive pollution to the globe. And thousands of oil spills every year. Every kind of we have no instinct for what we're doing to our own land. For example, these places which used to be called garbage dumps and are now called landfills are proliferating all over the damn where. Every year, thousands of more square miles of concrete adorn our glorious land. It doesn't even have most of it doesn't even have a feel of its own anymore.
Well, the let's get a response from our guest. The caller outlines a very dark view, and some people perhaps would share it, saying that essentially it's too late. Now, you've been around the world. You have spent time thinking about this and looking at conditions here in the United States and abroad. Do you share this, or do you find some reason to be optimistic?
Look, it is hard. I try not to be quite as gloomy as the caller, but I can't entirely disagree with his views. There is a lot of trends that are going in the wrong direction, as we said at the top of the hour. If we did have to begin to have turned these around in the last 10 years, we've clearly failed. Am I optimistic? No, but I am hopeful, and that's a crucial distinction. Optimism is a rational calculation, and if you look at the kinds of trends that the caller mentions and that I have indeed seen in my travels, it is hard to be optimistic. It is hard to make the numbers come out in a way that looks positive when you're looking at all the damage that exists already and the fact that our population is probably going to grow from 6 billion to 8 billion by the middle of this century. And those are all people that, as I said earlier, want to have a better life, and that will increase the environmental footprint. All of that's true. But what is the alternative? To just let that happen? No, I for one, refuse to do that. And the idea, the distinction between optimism and hope, yes, it looks very difficult to change that. But I venture to say that in 1981 and 1982, it looked like apartheid would never fall in South Africa. It looked like Soviet totalitarianism would never end. It looked like the nuclear arms race was a permanent condition for this planet. And those things all changed within a decade. And they changed not because of some historical luck of the draw, but because many, many people, most of whose names have now been lost to history, but many, many people in many, many communities around the world worked very hard to suggest alternative policies and did not give up, even though the situation looked hopeless. So I believe, as Václav Havel told me in our interview for Earth Odyssey, you have to live in hope.
Let's take another call. This caller is in Eureka, also on our toll-free line. Hello.
I wonder if the guest could comment on, in this country, there's very small movement toward renewable, sustainable resources like in agriculture and ethanol and soy oil and all that sort of thing. And would you care to comment on that and then also in other countries?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think that I wouldn't call that movement so small. Again, you have to be careful. Just because you're not hearing about something in the media doesn't mean that it's not happening out in the society. Speaking as a reporter, I can be quite adamant about that. It may have a small image in the media, but it is happening in a lot of places. And I think that essentially it's a two-step process. Right now, the most urgent thing right away is energy efficiency because it has a quicker impact. If you retrofit a building with lights and insulation and so forth, you can see your energy bills go down immediately. I'm from California. This is what happened last summer. This is how we avoided the blackouts in California. People were told to conserve through energy efficiency, and overall demand dropped 20% in a couple of months. Now, that is much faster than you can get any oil or coal-fired plant up, and indeed, than you can get a solar or a wind system up and running. So what we need to do is to increase energy efficiency in the short term and use that as a bridging mechanism to buy us the time to continue the transformation into solar and wind and so forth. And I think that there's a lot of activity out there in the business sector, and it would go a lot faster and farther if only our governments would give it the smallest bit of help.
I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about what you're working on now, because I think it's very timely and not unrelated to what we've already been talking about.
That's true. I just got back from another trip around the world, this one only 6 months. Began in May and finished in November, and this was to investigate a book about America and how it fascinates and infuriates the rest of the world and doesn't know why. I began thinking about this about a year ago on the basis of having spent so much time overseas as a reporter in 20 years and always being asked by my foreign friends and acquaintances, what is it with you Americans in one fashion or another? And then coming home and finding Americans very uninterested in what goes on overseas. And I thought I wanted to do a book that would try and explain America to the world and the world to America. And so, as I say, I began that in May, traveling around. I visited Asia, Africa, and Europe, mainly 15 countries. And then near the end of the trip, of course, September 11th happened and gave this whole question quite a bit new meaning and urgency in a tragic way. Mm-hmm. I think it's true. It's hard for us to remember now, but before September 11th, Americans rarely even thought about the rest of the world. Most of them were barely aware it existed. And in this, our new president is quite typical. I mean, he had been overseas, I believe, twice before taking the highest office in the land. And I think that part of that is because of geography and our history, but it is mainly because of the fact that we are the richest, most powerful nation on earth, and we basically figured that we could do what we wanted when we wanted, and if other people didn't like it, too bad. And September 11th, I think, tragically, made us learn the hard way that that's not the case. Not only are we not invulnerable, but we cannot afford any longer to ignore what the rest of the world thinks of us, thinks about us. And I'm not talking here about the Osama bin Ladens. That's too easy to dismiss. Mm-hmm. Though he's a nutcase and a dangerous nutcase who should be brought to justice. No question about that. But we should not forget that so-called anti-Americanism, that is to say criticism of America, was rising rapidly long before September 11th. And back in the spring and the summer of this year, a lot of the very tartest criticisms were coming from the allies who are now standing closest to us. Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of Britain, Jacques Chirac of France. Americans need to wake up to how we appear to the rest of the world.
Well, if you ask this question, what is it among the various things that bug people about the United States, what is it that bugs them most? Is it the attitude that we have displayed so often, the one that you touch on, this attitude that says, we're the United States, we're the biggest, most powerful country ever, and we can do whatever we want. And if you don't like it, tough.
Well, that's part of it. Now, let's broaden the discussion a little bit here, because, of course, the Bush administration is talking about this a little bit, and Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, will say that they don't like us because of our principles, because we stand for freedom, because we stand for democracy. That's why they don't like us. And that is probably true in some cases. But we have to realize that other people have a more rounded view, shall we say, of our approach to democracy and freedom. It does not help us, for example, when we go out and talk about freedom and criticize countries who are supposedly anti-democratic. And yet, what are we doing in the Middle East? We have supported Saudi Arabia, an autocratic regime where there is no democracy. And especially if you're a woman, you have no rights. We do the same in a whole Kuwait, Qatar, whole number of other places. Or, you know, very recently, getting back to the environmental issue here, you know, Mr. Bush went to the United Nations, gave his first speech before the General Assembly on November 10th, and lectured the rest of the world on not doing enough to help the U.S. fight terrorism and shirking their international responsibilities. Okay, fair enough. On that very same day, though, the United States is boycotting the negotiations to finalize the Kyoto Treaty. Now, you don't see that juxtaposition in the American press, but believe me, in Europe, they notice that. And they say, how dare you be so hypocritical? How dare you insist that we go along with your agenda on terrorism, yet you stand alone against the entire world in boycotting the global warming negotiations? And you know, this is not a one-time case. This has happened over and over and over in history. Now, I want to be clear. You know, I was overseas on September 11th, and people overseas felt very, very sorry for the United States about what happened. I remember being in Prague, and you go outside the embassy, and there are flowers and candles and notes written to the American people. There is an enormous amount of affection overseas for the American people. But they make a distinction between the American people and the American government and American foreign policy. And they are not so happy with American foreign policy because they see it as self-righteous, as hypocritical, and as arrogant.
So sometimes I think one gets the impression that in fact, that you touched on that fact that now some people say, well, the reason that some people in the chattering classes here in this country say, well, the reason that people abroad don't like us is that they don't like what we stand for. I think that there is also a sense, though, that in fact some people do actually appreciate what it is we say we stand for, and that part of the problem may indeed be that they perceive a gulf between what we say what we stand for and what we actually do. And then when it comes down to some of our most cherished ideas like freedom, the ability to make of yourself whatever you can, that is something that people other places say, well, yeah, actually, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, well, that's why I subtitle this book, How America Fascinates and Infuriates. You know, America is fascinating to outsiders, and they admire a lot about America. They admire what you're mentioning here, that we are the so-called land of opportunity. They admire that, unlike in their countries, where you are so often a captive of history or a captive of the class into which you were born, here in the United States, there's at least the perception, rightly or wrongly, that every day is new and anyone can have a different life if they work hard enough. Now, as I say, that's not always what turns out to be the case. But there is a lot of admiration. And also, I talked to an intellectual in Barcelona, for example, who said, look, we like the American people and we like the American culture. It's our culture now. We've listened to the music for so many years. We've watched the movies for so many years. We associate more with Kansas than we do with Toulouse. And Toulouse is 100 miles away. But we do wish our American friends would think a little more about politics, because we have to live with the decisions their government makes.
We have a couple of callers here. We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest, by the way, author, journalist Mark Hertzgard. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers. We'll start out here with Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and thank you very much for taking my call. It seems to me you're saying that, in effect, the problem is ignorance of the perceptions of the United States and its politics overseas on the part of the American people. Whose responsibility is that for communicating these other points of view to them? Where, if one were interested in a balanced set of perspectives, where would an interested person find these perspectives? It seems to me that the mass media are, to a great extent, complicit in this imbalance, and I would like to hear something about what your suggestions might be for getting out of it, that is, getting to a balanced perspective and a realization that there are some things we do that cause a great deal of upsetness and look at least inconsistent to people looking at us from other countries. I'll just listen to your response. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Excellent question, and you anticipate one of my points, which is, and I often find myself explaining this to people overseas, is that they just don't appreciate what a poor job the American news media does of serving the American public. It's not that Americans are uniquely stupid or uniquely uninterested in their fellow man, but rather their media is very much part of the problem, as the caller says. For example, on September 21st, you know, Mr. Bush gave this famous speech where he told the world, in the fight against terrorism, you are either with us or against us. Now, I was reading the European press at that time, and on the front page of Le Monde, the major daily in France, that was their headline, that was their subheadline, and it was in the first paragraph of the story on the front page. Then you, and naturally enough, then you pick up the same day's coverage of the International Herald Tribune, which, of course, is the international paper put out by the New York Times and Washington Post. They cover the same speech on the same front page, big picture of President Bush. That quote is nowhere on the front page, and you have to go all the way to the jump page inside the paper, the 20th paragraph, and there's the quote. Now, that gives you a sense of why Americans have no recognition of how we look around the world. to get to the caller's question, what to do about it? Well, one thing that you can do now in the internet era is to seek out coverage from overseas, from mainstream European networks. I think on a lot of the NPR and PBS stations now in America, you can get the BBC. Watch the BBC. And if you want to have a little fun, watch the BBC and then watch CNN. And it is like two different planets. Likewise with radio, likewise now with internet, you can check the British papers. An excellent paper is the London Independent. They have the single best guy writing about this stuff now is a guy named Robert Fisk, who's been covering these foreign issues for a very long time. Here at home, it's tougher. Most of the mainstream media is simply indisposed to make these kinds of points, as my example illustrates. I do think that you can find this information, but you've got to go to what, to the progressive magazines that are much smaller in circulation, what the great journalist I.F. Stone used to call America's Samizdat. I'm speaking of magazines like The Nation, the great weekly out of New York. They've been pretty clear about all this stuff for a very long time. I think they're terrific. And the Progressive magazine, I'm told, has had some good coverage of this recently. Salon.com is another internet place that you can look for this. But you really do have to seek it out on your own if you're going to get this kind of a perspective.
Next caller is Chicago. This is line number one right here. Hello.
Thank you. I've appreciated your work since you wrote the Earth Odyssey, and I've advocated others to read it and talk about it.
Thank you.
And I think word of mouth is getting around about the conditions that are existing more and more. Certainly, the Greens Party had some minimal, seminal influence on awakening us to the environmental issues, along with Ralph Nader and others. But as you just commented, how little coverage Nader and others were given because of their views on the environment and so forth. But one of the principles about how people regard this country, uppermost being the matter of freedom, it seems though one reason we didn't approve the Kyoto Accord was because it would inhibit our freedom of economic expansion and inroads into other countries where the rules were lower and on the environment issues, and anything that would reduce our capacity to make inroads into these other regions, say in a search for oil in Africa and other things, and go in there exploiting them and devastating them and with disregard to the environmental impact, was something we weren't ready to give up as long as we can still get away with it. But I really appreciate hearing you and your viewpoints throughout the program. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further comment you want to make on the points of the call?
Well, I don't think that's look, we didn't go into Kyoto because George Bush, as I said earlier, he's an oil man, and Kyoto means you're going to use less oil. It's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm. Just to return to this to the subject of how people around the world feel about us and why it is sometimes that they're annoyed and we don't quite get it. I am interested in the reaction of people around the world to American popular culture, which has become so, I'm sure that it's inescapable.
Inescapable.
And that is one of those.
And they don't want to escape it either, by the way.
Well, see, that's interesting. That's an interesting point because I guess the impression one would get, well, I suppose it depends on who you ask how you feel about American popular culture, whether it's terrible, whether it's junk, or whether it's got the kind of values that you don't like. But it does seem that it's not something that you're really going to be able to get away from, no matter where you are.
Well, I think back to, I interviewed a couple of retired terrorists in the Islamic Quarter in Cairo. And these are guys who were sitting around in a tea shop at 11 o'clock in the morning playing backgammon. And they had retired from the terrorist business. They were old and had been put in jail and all of that under Mubarak's government, another government that in Egypt that we support that has, no sense of democracy. But even they, who definitely saw America as the great Satan and said, no, we have nothing we can learn from America, there's nothing good about America, et cetera, even they said, oh, yeah, we did like Humphrey Bogart movies. We did like Humphrey Bogart movies, you know. Now,
I'm glad it wasn't Britney Spears.
Well, I was just going to say, you talk to their grandchildren, and it's a completely different story. I think back to being in South Africa, for example, and a young guy, you know, about 30, young father, he had two young kids, drove a bus, and we got to know one another a little bit. And when he found out I was from America, he was thrilled. Oh, America has a very great influence on our country. I said, is it a good influence? Oh, it's a very good influence. And he said, you know, what we like about America is that people have a lot there. People live a good life there. And people are free there. And, you know, all of these kinds of things. What I was struck by was that as the conversation went on, he added, without any sense of irony, he lived in a township right outside of Cape Town, and he said, do you realize that every township in South Africa has a gang, many gangs, but has a street gang called the Young Americans, and another street gang called the Ugly Americans? I said, really? What's the difference between the two? And he said, well, the Young Americans dress like Young Americans, by which he meant sort of the hip-hop look. You know, urban, the look you would see on MTV, basically, of urban rap singers, hip-hop singers or what have you. And says, so the Young Americans dress like Young Americans, and the Ugly Americans shoot like Ugly Americans. And the Ugly Americans were the gangs who handled the drugs and who were the heavy gang, mm-hmm. and the Young Americans were the sort of the guys who just kind of like to dress like Young Americans. That gives you a sense of the enormous space that the image of America occupies in people's minds around the world.
So when do you think this book is going to be a book?
This book will be out next fall from Farrar, Straus & Giroux in this country and 9 other countries.
Well, perhaps we'll talk again.
I hope so.
In the meantime, if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to hear more from our guest, Mark Hertzgard. He'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series tonight, 7:30, at the Levis Center. So anyone is welcome to attend. Again, thanks very much.
It's nice to be here.